Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Francis Bacon, readings from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers. So it gives you a generalized view, going through different the philosophers in context of the other philosophers, very much a closed little universe looking at philosophers, and doesn't necessarily cover some aspects that are fascinating to scientists, i.e. They look at Francis Bacon's theories, whether he did discover gunpowder as a general or fixed upon the ratio to discover gunpowder, his scientific exploits are really unknown. There's also his context in Elizabethan or Renaissance society as a window into what's going on, the cross between politics and men of the world, and natural philosophers, the smaller work or area of refined work of universities focusing on rather theology rather than teleology, going through here. Then they also cover Francis Bacon in his cautions, critiques of views, which can necessarily be used as critique almost nowadays, because a lot of the Renaissance sort of circular logic is actually used in commercial and marketing terms. So a lot of people who want to spin something have to actually make something out of nothing. And essentially, that's what a lot of Renaissance people were doing, make something out of nothing. There was also the corporate view, allegiance, team view, allegiance in Renaissance society. You were in a particular noble, you're noble won or lost. And we sort of have a similar thing where people are associated with government or a commercial enterprise or they're self-employed. There are all these areas that you're involved in, and there's sort of similar faults that come across. And the major thing is that whether syllogism, the concept of syllogism and how that corresponds to the application of modern science, and syllogistically, that's how we operate all the time, and that's how we actually apply science by syllogism. That is, syllogism you'd use in, say, calibration of an instrument. You would calibrate your instrument to a known voltage source, and that voltage source is true or is calibrated, and then you could say, well, my voltage reading measurement applies to all things. So, and he said, well, this has got a fundamental flaw in it, and it's hard explained in this way. Sort of science has a fairly clear understanding, and so there's three I've forgotten the actual name. It's the basics of applying logic to discover truth. I've got to actually think what that's actually called. There's a class of logic, and there's three basic strategies. That's deductive logic, inductive logic, and abductive logic. So abductive is just more a guess where it's uncertain that your conclusion or your data is correct. It's the two sorts of things. So deductive logic is where is the syllogistic or the original type of stuff, and the Francis Bacon is pointing out and introducing inductive logic. And then we've got abductive logic, which we sort of apply in the field, getting between the two, leaping between the two. So deductive logic starts off with a premise which is true, and a subcase, which is a premise for applying to all subcases is true, and then something is a member of a subcase. So a class of things are true, and something is a member of a class, so that membership means that that's true. So you define truth by starting off with a pile of true things, and then you can extend the truth of it, the properties of truth. So you can see that something's a member of a class, which is true. Class is true. Something's a member of class, and therefore that's true. And so you've got that fundamental, I forgot what the term is. I've just used it, syllogism. It means together logic. Symbiotic. A seal means together logic. So that's the classic, hail causes all damage to things that are outside, unprotected. My car's outside, therefore it will be damaged by the hail. The damage is caused by the hail. So we can see some truth, that although I may not have seen, my car being destroyed by hail, I've seen everything else destroyed that's outside, and my car is also outside, so it was destroyed by hail, even though I can't see it. So this is a fundamental way of expanding your logic. So you don't necessarily have to witness everything. So this is the entire process of logic, is where you can deduce things without actually having the direct data. It's extending the amount of data or truth by thought. So this is, you have a situation, you apply thought to it, and you expand the amount of truth. So deductive reasoning, or syllogism, which is a Renaissance stuff, and it's developed from text. This is why you need the Bible is truth, God is truth, and you just say is truth, is a member of, and therefore you can actually railroad people. So syllogism and deductive reasoning operates very much on a top-down process in logic, and also in society and in structures of society. So if you can't challenge anything, if you can't challenge the truth of things, you can actually pump things from the downward truth. And a lot of people, a lot of totalitarian regimes, a lot of corrupt regimes have a syllogistic effect where they have regions where you can't actually access to, you can't challenge them, so they can actually move truth together and come in the middle of the night and take you away, because they've got a series of truth which are there operating. Now, so this is not the process of a scientific experiment. There would be no need to do an experiment, because truth is found by membership of truths of truths. Now, Francis Bacon said, oh, we have to do experiments, and experiments is the opposite type of things. And that is, you observe sufficient things, and then you create a class. And that class may or may not be true, depending on the amount of observations you do. You will observe, my friend's car got hit by hail, other friends got hit by hail, my car got hit by hail, and all cars have got hit by hail. It's just, you can have a mechanism behind it, but you go from specific, so from the other, so deductive is top down, and inductive is top up. You induce it. Now, in the mathematical version of it, you can say that you can do a series. You can prove it for the case n, and then if n is correct, and you can prove that if n is correct, it's true for n plus 1. Therefore, you can put n plus 1 into n, and then you just, boom, you can prove it for all numbers. So inductive reasoning in mathematics is very powerful. In science, it's a slight bit different. You can prove it for most cases, and then you have to then construct construct something which is true for all, see if you can find an exception to it. So this is where you require falsification or things, and you prove, so deductive reasoning is the case of experiments, and deductive reasoning proves or disproves a hypothesis. So this is why you require a hypothesis, and the hypothesis can be proved or disproved. And I think Francis Bacon actually says some more intense things here when I actually read about it. And this is constructing rather than just blindly turning the handle. When you read it, unfortunately, I'm a bit tired now, and I can't quite remember. I have a feeling that when I've read this, he's talking about a more intelligence. He has a more intelligent slant on this in terms of so deductive, the boundary of knowledge. There can be no new premises. You can only be new because it's top down. The premises are the same, and it's logical. In the other one, inductive is producing new premises or new conclusions. So, so a premise is a conclusion which you accept is true. A conclusion is needs to be tested. So, if you come into a situation with a conclusion, that's a premise. If you take observations, you produce a conclusion which is true or false. Now, reading to Bacon, he was actually saying some more things in here. I can't quite remember it. But there is obviously a higher level strategy you can have, sort of depending on the people involved. If you have people properly trained, they will know when and where to apply inductive reasoning, deductive reasoning, put a combination strategy together and actually physically solve problems, and rather than randomly spreading out like say if you drop ink on the carpet, it sort of spreads out the way it goes. It's sort of a much more intelligent, directed way, the sort of intelligence to science, which is, I can really read in them, but it's got to sort of poke around in my brain. So it is deductive reasoning. Now, again, in schools, we don't teach the difference between it. There's also the an inference. Forming an inference is the process of inductive reasoning. So I see something is a case, and something is also a case from experience. I add those two truths together to get a third truth. So inductive reasoning, but inductive reasoning is really necessary. What I was going to say is that exams tend to produce, inductive reasoning, because they give you true statement A, true statement B, and you can actually produce the next statement. So inductive reasoning is actually a mechanical process which involves understanding to get it correct. Experiments are deductive reasoning, so this is why you really need practice exams as well, that you can see the two reasonings across. Again, whether in year 7 you can actually teach in a very simple way this going forward. Even teaching here, I think we need to actually be addressing a higher level of group organization. This is, I'd say, strategic reasoning. Now, there's also abductive reasoning, which is neither one or the other. You don't have sufficient data to be true. You don't have sufficient conclusions to be true. You have the most likely information and most likely conclusion, and you put it together. It's sitting between the two, and you have to do a combination across that's there. So how you'd form that forward, and so this is one of the interesting things in that it sort of signifies, reading this signifies that we haven't done a really good job in teaching education, general education, between deductive, inductive reasoning and the scientific method. So there is the primitive scientific method of inductive reasoning, and inductive reasoning requires experiment and to be communicated, because inductive reasoning, as he talks about here, inductive reasoning, and again he says, is almost valueless if it's done by an individual. An individual can do inductive reasoning, and he comes and goes, and because inductive reasoning generates new knowledge, and you don't share it there, but you need to share inductive reasoning, and you've got new knowledge. You really need to, it has to be communal affair. And so you can see this sort of reasoning driving Francis Bacon to suggest society, social, a group cause. And so this is deductive reasoning is something which is can only operate system-wide, whereas inductive reasoning is much more political. You can have one group of inductive reasoning, and if you don't agree with them, they kill you. It's much more tribal, inductive reasoning. Deductive reasoning is a meta understanding for a meta society, and in that sense, science is really a meta society going through. I hope I've made myself clear here. I've understood it a bit more. I have to go back and think of the general class of the general process of being smart, but being smart collectively, which is sort of really strange in terms of inductive reasoning is very measurable. You can actually give people a set of give them one correct statement, and then they have to bring in their own correct statement to make a correct conclusion. So you can actually test it that way, and it's a very individual inductive or group within a group, whereas deductive reasoning by necessity has to be system-wide, and you have these system-wide ideas, but it's then not necessarily something easy to teach and get out across there. So there's something for us to teach down the track to get going. Now, this is section 6, episode 5. I can't believe I've read this far. Now, science and social philosophy. In Bacon's thought, we encounter a relation between science and social philosophy. This is exactly what I was saying, that you require science and social philosophy has to, since society concerning the utopian transformation of society presuppose integration into the social framework of a program concerning natural philosophy and technology as two forms of the makers of makers' knowledge. This is really exactly what I'm saying, that the logical consequence of induction is making knowledge. So induction makes knowledge, deduction exploits knowledge. So you don't use induction when you're measuring someone's electricity. You're using induction. That is, my measurement is true, your meter is true, therefore my bill is true. Induction. It looks scientific, but it's the separate. And it's also interesting about how people use teacher's demonstration. From its point of view, which was influenced by the Puritan conceptions, early modern society has to make sure that losses caused by the fall are compensated primarily by man's enlargement of knowledge. Wow. Providing the preconditions for a new form of society which combines scientia, nova, and the millennium according to the prophecy of Daniel. Wow. I just find this is just mind-blowing. It's still gone back to religion in terms of the fall means you're on your own, and science is your way back to God. I don't know what the prophecy of the millennium What is the prophecy of Daniel 12.4? What is it? Well, I remember to get that out. My head's really sore at the moment, guys. Science as a social endeavour is seen as a collective project for the improvement of social structures. This is awesome. On the other hand, a strong collective spirit in society may function as a conditio sine qua non for reforming natural philosophy. I love it. Bacon's famous argument is that it's not wise to confound the book of nature with the book of God comes into focus, since the latter deals with God's will, is suitable for man, and the former with God's work. Scientific explanation or appreciation is a form of Christian divine service. Successful operations in natural philosophy and technology help to improve man's lot in a way which makes the hardship of life after the fall obsolete. It is important to note that Bacon's idea of a, to a certain extent, Christian society is by no means conveys Christian pessimism in the vein of patristic thinkers, but rather displays a clear optimism as a result of compounding the problem of truth with the scope of human freedom and sovereignty. With regard to Bacon's two books, The Book of God and The Book of Nature, one has to keep in mind that man, when given free access to the Book of Nature, should not concern himself with meddling reading it. He also Now that's brilliant, The Book of Nature. Now, why not have a Bible club on the Book of Nature? What does it mean? Has to find out the names by which things are called. If man does so, not only will he be restored to the status of a noble and powerful being, but the Book of God will also lose importance from a traditional point of view in comparison to the Book of Nature. This is what Blumberg referred to as the asymmetry of readability. But the process of reading is an open-ended activity, so the new knowledge and the expansion of the system of disciplines can no longer be restricted by concepts such as completeness, eternity of knowledge, which is true, that the Book of God is coming across here. It's a very interesting way to go. According to Bacon, the Book of God refers to his will, the Book of Nature, to his works. He never gives a hint in his works that he has concealed any message of unbelief for the sophisticated reader. But he emphasizes, one, that religion and science should be kept as kept separate, and they are nevertheless complementary to each other. For Bacon, the attack of the theologians on human curiosity cannot be founded on a rational basis. This statement that, quote, all knowledge is to be limited by religion and to be referred to use in action, does not express the general verdict of the theoretical curiosity, but instead provides a normative framework for the task of science in a universal sense. Already, in a dedicatory letter to James I, in his Advancement of Learning, Bacon attacks the zeal and jealousy of divines. And his manuscript, Philum Labyrinthi, in 1607, he, quote, thought how great opposition and prejudice natural philosophy had received by superstition and a moderate and blind zeal of religion. Wow. So you just think of Trump at the moment. As Calvin had done long before him in Institutes, Bacon stated that since God created the physical world, it was a legitimate object for man's knowledge, a conviction which he illustrated with a famous example of King Solomon and the Advancement of Learning. Bacon praises Solomon's wisdom, which seems to be more like a game than an example of man's God-given thirst for knowledge. Quote, the glory of God is to conceal a thing, but the glory of a king is to find it out. As if, according to an innocent play of children, the divine majesty took delight to hide his works to the end to have us found out. And if kings could not obtain greater honour than God's playfellows in that game, considering the great commandment of wits and means, whereby nothing needeth to be hidden from them. Wow, what a beautiful thought. from this perspective, the punishment of mankind on account of the very first disobedience by Adam and Eve can be seen in a different light from that of the theological interpretations. In Bakin view, this disobedience and its consequences can be remedied in two ways, by religion and moral imperatives, and by the advancement of the arts and sciences. This is, I can't see why this is, I really can't see that science should really employ professional theologians. The purpose in advancing arts and sciences is the glory of God and the relief of man's estate. The two remedies, which are interconnected with moral dimension, refer to the advancement of learning and religion. All three together, the advancement of learning, religion, and morality, are combined in such a way that they promote each other mutually. Consequently, limited outlooks on coping with life, knowledge, are ruled out completely in these three fields. What I was going to say is that I teach lessons in ethics, the science behind ethics. And that's a real eye-opener. So these poor little kids have been taught deductive reasoning and to be tested and examined, and of course they can't think for themselves. Seven. Oh, here we go. Look, I'm truly talk about ethics. I suppose my eye doesn't see this first. I don't read it. I suppose my head must be getting back to a bit. So it's my poor brain. God, I just can't remember. There's last time I was going to remember something from that last page. And I really can't remember what I had to remember. Oh dear. I'll have to go back and search it. I'll probably need a smartphone or something like that. The ethical dimension of Bakin's thought has been underrated by generations of scholars. Time and again, a crude utilitarian has been derived from Book 1, Aphorism 1 of Novarin Ogami. This cannot, however, withstand a closer analysis of his thought. Since Bakin's philosophy of science tries to answer the question of how man can overcome the deficiencies of life on Earth, earthly life resulting from the fall, he enters the realm of ethical reflection. The improvement of man's lot by means of philosophy and science does not start from a narrow utilitarian point of view, involving sheer striving for profit, supporting the power of influence and select groups of men, but instead emphasizes the construction or better world of mankind, which might come into existence through the ascertaining the truths about nature's workings. You know what? It just making me think that you really need to identify what you are doing for inductive, abductive reasoning as you're teaching in class, because people are taught deductive reasoning and stop when they have to do inductive reasoning, or they do an inductive experiment in a deductive way. And it's really interesting the way that the teachers set up experiment write-ups that induction does not actually occur. Thus, the perspective of universal in Bakin's ethical thought is given predominance. The range of science and technology in the ethical meaning transcends the realm of application of tools and or instruments as the aim is the transformation of the whole systems. And this is what I said earlier, that induction is a system-wide thing. Since causality and finality can interact on the basis of human will and knowledge, the plurality of worlds becomes feasible. Moral philosophy is closely connected to ethical reflections on the relationship between nature of virtues, habitual or innate, and their use in life privately and collectively. Any application of principles of virtue presupposes Bakin, the education of the mind, so that we can learn what is good and what should be attained. Ah, yeah, I just wanted, it's the millennium prediction. What is the millennium prediction? That's what I wanted to do. And this is a quote from Bakin. The main and primitive division of moral knowledge seemeth to be the exemplar of, or platform of good, the regimen of culture of mind, describing the nature of good, the other prescribing rules how to subdue, apply, and accommodate the will of man unto. Now that's an amazing thought. That whether you should get teach by the mechanism of ethical problems. So already in his advancement of learning, Bacon studied the nature of good and distinguished various kinds of good. He insisted on individuals' duty to the public, private moral self-control, and the concomitant obligations are relevant for behaviour and actions in society. One, the ethical persona is connected to the morality by reference to accepted behaviour. Though what we can do may be limited, we have to muster our psychological powers and control our passions when dealing with ourselves and with others. Now this is Woolsey. Yeah. We need to apply self-discipline and rational assessments as we are restraining our passions in order to lead active moral lives in society. Which is rather interesting, because when push comes to shove, Bacon was a pretty sly sort of Renaissance man. Thus, for Bacon, the acquisition of knowledge does not simply coincide with the possibility of exerting power. Scientific knowledge is the condition for the expansion and development of civilization. Therefore, knowledge and charity cannot be kept separate. Wow. This is a quote. I humbly pray that knowledge being now discharged of that venom which the serpent infused into it, and which makes man makes the mind of man swell, we may not be wise above the measure of sobriety to cultivate the truth in charity. Oh, it's so close to what I believe. Lastly, I would address one general admonition of all, that they consider what are the true ends of knowledge, and they see, and not either for pleasure of mind or contention, or superiority of others, or profit of fame or power, or any of these inferior things, but the benefit and the use of life. And they perfect and govern it in charity. For it was whom the lust of power the angels fell. From lust of knowledge man fell. But for charity there can be no excess. Neither did angel or man ever come to danger by it. What a fantastic thing. That is really the credo of scientists. Scientists are there. They're there for you. They're there for science. There for you. There for truth. And this is actually this concept is actually built into the artificial construct of a scientist developed by the British Association for the Advancement of Scientists. Finally, the view that Bacon's Nova Atlantis concerns a utopian society that is carefully organized for the purpose of scientific research and virtuous living holds true his entire life's work. In Nova Atlantis, social, political, and scholarly life are all organized according to the maxims of efficiency. But the House of Solomon is a separate and highly esteemed institution for research, which nevertheless is closely connected to the overall system of Ben Salem. In his utopian state, Bacon represents a thoroughgoing collective life in society and science, both of which are based on revealed religion. Religion, Christian in essence, is not dogmatic, but instills into the people of Ben Salem, veneration for the wise and morally exemplary members of society, and, which of the utmost importance, is the strictest sense of discipline. And what I really think is that this is all great, but there's these people, there's always gamers and crooks out there. Discipline is indispensable for those involved in religious life as well as for researchers, since both must proceed methodically. The isomorphic structure of nature and science on the one hand, society and religion on the other, prescribes patterns of political procedure, social processes and religious attitudes which overcome any craving for individuality. If religion and scientific research are both shown as truthful in Ben Salem, then, according to Bacon, the imagination functions as a mean of illustrating scientific revelation. Bacon's purpose is to show that scientific research properly pursued is not inconsonant with religious property and social stability. The scientist in Bethlehem, Sacred Searches of Truth, Ethics and Religion and Science Merge. Bacon's parabolic strategy, which we would seem not to separate the power of idols, enables him... we should not separate from the power of idols, enables him to make such of his trick of introducing new ideas like a smuggler. His coloured wares are smuggled into the minds of his readers by being visualised in terms of sacred and highly symbolic rituals. Well, he does smuggle things, seeing with this analogy. Of course, people are reading Bacon. They don't read me or anything like that. Science and religion are separated in Nova Atlantis, but they are also interrelated through the offices of the Society of Bensalem. What Bacon obviously wants to make clear to his readers is that the example of Bensalem should free them from any fear that scientific progress will lead to chaos and upheaval. This is a crucial point made by Jürgen Michelstraß, who understands Bacon never as a utopian and regards utopia as, quote, the blueprints of practical reason, not of theoretical, that is. They're set in exactly there where the early modern idea of progress appears meagre with regard to its contents within ethics and political theory. Well, there you go. That concludes that. And I think that's the major aspect of it. What we have to do is say, I think if you start off with Bensalem and work from there, that will be better than actually layering through the little bit pieces piecemeal in the way that he developed in his life. I think Bensalem, Nova Atlantis, is the way to go. There's some things that we can form up in the way we teach science. Science a little bit bigger, a little bit better. And the general view, that's Francis Bacon, who born in 1561 and died in 1626, age 25. 65. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.